Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here today. We have a full house to hear from Karlfried. He just reminded me how to pronounce his last name properly. Can you remind me again, Karlfried?
Fröhlich. But in America, we say Fröhlich.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
As we can tell by how many people we have gathered here today, Karlfried has been a speaker with us before, and we are so excited to hear from him again. He will be speaking about Christmas art in Florence today. As a brief introduction to those of you who have not heard Karlfried before, he is a native of Saxony, Germany. He moved to the United States in 1964, taught at Drew University, and then he was a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, where he held the Benjamin B. Warfield Chair in Church History. Karlfried is an active member of the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. His scholarly interests include the history of Christian art and the history of biblical interpretation, a field to which he has contributed significantly through his teaching and writing. Before I hand it over to Karlfried, I ask that you join me in a moment of prayer. Gracious God, thank you for the gift of art. Thank you for creativity, for inspiration, for your word. Thank you for Karlfried and his dedication to teaching. Be with us this morning. Open our ears, our eyes, our hearts to your word. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you so much. And with that, I hand over our morning to Karlfried.
Okay, can you hear me? Yeah? All right. Now, what I propose to do today is to finish up what I started last year in Advent. Now, how many of you were not here last year? Oh, yeah, quite a few. So yes, I do need to give a little bit more of the introduction. I didn't get very far last year because there's always much more to tell you than there's time. So, you know, I am mindful of the problem of time, and I will hopefully get through today more easily and to the very end. Now, Christmas art in Florence, it has to do with Florence at the height of Florence as a city of European importance, particularly the 15th century. In Italian they say the Quattrocento. These are the 1400s. Most of it, that is, you know, where the Renaissance was at its peak, taking its beginning, the Renaissance, in Florence. We'll see some of this, you know, in the art of it as well. Now, you know, Europe around 1400 looked like this in terms of the territories there. You see, it's basically three large areas. There is the Muslim world on the east, and it's all over the Mediterranean. By that time, of course, it started in the 7th century, 8th century, at the time of Muhammad. But, it grew, and actually the movement took over much of the what we call now the Near East. It's near in terms of, you know, thinking from Western Europe. But the West at that time also was split into two parts. The Eastern part, where the Eastern Church, Greek Church, and the Russian Church held sway, and the West with Rome as the center in Italy there, and the far west was Spain, kingdom of Castile at that time, the south of the Iberian Peninsula was still held at that time by Muslim powers, and of course all of North Africa was Muslim territory. The East was the Byzantine Empire, and it had large chunks in there. There's the blue area, that's the Kingdom of Hungary. East of it, the light blue, that was at that time a very large area, which was the Polish-Lithuanian empire. Well, it's not an empire, it's just a very large area. And then what's Germany today was split into many smaller areas. France also was, of course, a large power with the king. The German territories are part of the Holy Roman Empire, which was the revival of the old Roman Empire, which actually, in early times, as the Roman Empire was all over this map. Everything here was part of the old Roman Empire, but that didn't exist anymore. There was only a Byzantine emperor there who was the counterpart of the Western emperor. The Western emperors started with Charlemagne, who in the year 800, being crowned emperor again after long centuries where the Roman Empire already had expired, crowned himself, the new emperor of the Western part. And of course, Italy was a big part of it and was in the center of many controversies, particularly because there was the Pope in Rome and there was the Emperor who, being the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, as they called it, he was normally the successors of Charlemagne were crowned by the Pope. So, the religion, Catholicism, had these two big parts, Eastern Christianity, Eastern Christianity with its major seat of the Byzantine Emperor in Constantinople, which is named after Constantine, who started, that entity. And then in the West, with an emperor who normally was a Germanic king, king of Germany, who also then was crowned by the emperor, by the Pope, as the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So keep in mind these three entities, the large Muslim-held areas, the Eastern Christian Empire Byzantium, with its center in Constantinople, and the Western Holy Roman Empire with its center in Rome. Now, how does Florence fit in? First of all, from your geography, you probably all know where Italy is. It's that long leg there sticking out into the Mediterranean. And actually, this was quite an important territory of its own, where Florence held, where Florence held quite a. Here we need to go back. Here we go back.
It's responding only very slowly.
Yeah, there, yeah. Here you see Italy, not yet this one, the previous one.
It's just going on its own. Oh, it's on an automated, it's an on an automated, I don't know how to stop that.
Yeah.
Sorry, we have to start it again.
Yeah, now the next one. Yeah. That's, as it says, it's the main cities of the Renaissance in Italy at the time around 1400, the beginning of the Quattrocento. You see there's Rome in the middle of the boot. Then there's the Kingdom of Naples south of it. And then there are some big cities, starting in the north with Venice. You see Venice over there close to the yellow territory. Then there is Milan, which is just beyond the map in that green area on top. And then there comes Florence as a major a city. Lucca is close by, as you see there. And then in the north also there is the yellow territory on the left, the city, port, and territory of Genoa. In the south there, yeah, the southern kingdom was the kingdom of Naples, and as you can see, there's not much of big cities in the south there anyway. But you know, these are the main cities. And why is Florence so important at this time? Well, Florence had grown from being a being founded as a colony for ex-soldiers in the Roman Empire. One of, the people that ruled in Rome in the second century BC, before Christ, had settled former soldiers in that city. And that's where, you know, the city of Florence started. It grew to a much more powerful entity in the early Middle Ages. And the main contribution to Europe, why Florence was so important for all of Europe, was money. The money economy at the time had as its standard of valuation the value of the main gold coin of the time, which was minted in Florence and was called the florin. So actually, you know, since all major transactions had to be done by hard currency, the earlier standard was silver coins, but you see gold is more valuable than silver. So the gold coins, the larger gold coins that were around in the early Middle Ages, the most valuable ones were the gold coins of Florence, the florin. Now that meant that many people in Florence during those centuries around the 1400s, actually it started in the 12th century already, the 1100s, and then of course the 13th century, the 1200s. These are the great times of the ascension of Florence to be the main European power because of its gold florin standard, which by that time then was recognized everywhere in Europe. Now on this little map, you can see how Florence is situated with its own territory around some other very important areas, Arezzo, Siena, Grosseto, Livorno, which included the island of Elba. You see it where the eye of Livorno is, you know, right underneath the name of Livorno. That is the island of Elba, well known because it was the place where Napoleon, much later, was exiled to. Then, close to Florence is Siena. For art, it's the predecessor of great art at the time of the Renaissance, and the Florentine masters still learned a lot of the old Sienese ones from Siena. Then there are further neighbors like Pisa and Lucca, very powerful city-states. They all were competitors with Florence, and there were wars fought between a Florentine army and the Florentine rulership, which was the Signoria. They had quite an army, and by the 16th century, all of this area, which as a territory, is called Tuscany, Toscana, was under the sway of Florence. The wars with Lucca and Pisa ended with victory for Florence in the 16th century. Only Lucca kept some independence from Florence. The others were all, you know, governed by the rulers of Florence, which at that time were the Medici, famous Medici family in Florence. Now, this is Florence today, and you can see it has a lot of important buildings there, the main one being the cathedral, the Duomo, with a wonderful cupola, one of the great works of engineering, which also, you know, was built during the Quattrocento, the 1400s. Brunelleschi was the person who, as an engineer and as an architect, finally finished this cupola. The Duomo itself existed before, but in much smaller dimensions. By 1400, it was not quite this way. In the 1430s, it was finished with the cupola intact. And then there are a number of other towers that you see. There are more churches visible everywhere, although you cannot see them very well on this picture. Now, around 1400, the city did not quite look the same way it looks now. Yeah, let's see the next picture. Yeah, here you see a little bit more of, you know, the situation. Like the Duomo, the cathedral, has a bell tower there. This bright structure on the left, we'll come to this. It's one of the works of one of the great artists of Florence, namely of Giotto di Bondone. And you see here on the left the main tower of City Hall and a number of other towers. Let's go to the next picture. Yeah, around, this is Florence around 1500. That means 100 years later, and you still see all these, the main buildings. There was a wall all around the town, and there was a river, the Arno River, that flows, you know, through Florence, with a number of famous bridges connecting a newer Florence area on the right with the main city on the left here. So this is more the way it looked, you know, during the time we are talking about with all this Christmas art we are going to look at. Now, this is a neighboring city nowadays called San Gimignano, and it's famous for these towers. You have to think of the city of Florence, which we saw right before this, looking pretty much this way around 1400, because all the well-to-do families had towers of their own, every one of them, which, you know, was always a sign of their wish to dominate. Now, in Florence, there was a law in the 14th century already that restricted the height of these towers to much less than what San Gimignano shows today. San Gimignano is just so good when you travel in Italy and you look at San Gimignano. That's the way Florence looked, you know, around 1400. Lots of towers, because there were lots of significant families that all vied for the domination in the city and beyond. Now, main features of the city were the churches. I only show you a couple of them, because all of them were very important for Christmas art, but art in general in Florence during the Renaissance. This is Santa Maria Novella. You see, it has a major tower, and it has inside quite a number of famous pictures, particularly on the altars, and of course also statuary from the time, which was prized by churches, you know, as the more precious stuff. Altars were painted mainly, sometimes with some sculpture just on them as well, but the statuary was even more prized because it was more costly. Here comes another famous church. When you are in Florence, you always want to visit this one. It is the church and the monastery of San Marco, one of the great places there, with a lot of art in there. It also was built in this form in the Quattrocento, during the time we are mainly talking about the early or main time of the Renaissance, and it had behind this wonderful facade of the church, not only the church, but then also the buildings for monks. In fact, it was built at the expense of the Medici family, in order to house a community of Dominican friars. Actually, one of the great Medici people brought them here shortly before the 1400 from a neighboring town, namely from Fiesole, where there had been Dominicans before, and so now a whole community of those friars were settled at San Marco in Florence. Yeah, so that was Florence. Now, beyond these churches, a place where much of the Christmas art is concentrated are the museums of the town. Florence is rich in museums. This is the major one, namely the Uffizi. You've probably heard about that. It's one of the major places to visit in Florence. You can't simply walk in, as you can in other museums. You nowadays have to make reservation, and they will, when you tell them on what day you want to come, they will give you a time when you have to show up, and you will not be admitted, at your will, but at the will of the administration there. Another one of these museums is the City Hall itself, a major building with an older tower overlooking the city. It's important to have towers like this, in particular for City Hall, because of the danger of fire. So you always had people watching the entire city from this tower and giving the alarm when fires are being spotted. So then measures could be taken to extinguish those fires. Another big museum is the Palazzo of Medici. That means the palace which the Medici family built for its own use. A building in the 1400s. It has a very distinct form of building blocks of stones. They stand out, it's not a straight facade, but as you see in the rez-de-chaussée, on the lowest level, these are stones with a protruding surface. Looks very rustic. It's called the Florence Rustica, the rustic form. Now, because of all the Christmas art in Florence, Florence is very proud of its Christmas celebration. As the text says, it's the whole month of December. That means including all the Advent Sundays. That is regarded as Christmas festivity in Florence. No, not yet. In fact, Florence regards itself nowadays as the Christmas capital of the world. And as you see here at the very end, everyone, they say, should have been in his or her lifetime once to Christmas in Florence, because that's the center of Christmas celebration in Europe. So, there are all kinds of illuminations in the town, more than one Christmas tree, garlands of electric lights and fireworks at this time. So it's really a big celebrational season. Now, when you look for Christmas art, you ask yourself, what would it show? The oldest Christian art of which we know is found in the catacombs. In Rome, there are a number of catacombs which you can visit nowadays. There are catacombs in some of the ancient cities in North Africa, like what used to be the city of Carthage. Naples in southern Italy, has also catacombs. And in those catacombs, the question is, where would the oldest, what would the oldest Christmas pictures show? Well, this is, as far as we know, the oldest picture of Christmas that we have. It shows a woman holding a child on the right, and on your left, a man kind of talking to her and raising his right arm. Well, that seems to be a good Christmas picture. Mary and the child and Joseph. No, it's not Joseph. This person, the man on the left, is a prophet who's mentioned in the book of Numbers in the Old Testament. He was a prophet by profession. So he could be hired. And he was hired, according to Numbers 24, by a king of the realm through whose territory the Israelites were marching, you know, after they had left the Sinai Peninsula on their way to Palestine, to the Holy Land. They crossed through Barak's territory, and he was afraid of them because there were so many. They were like grasshoppers, you know, needing food and kind of depleting what he thought, you know, were his realm's treasures. So he hired this prophet for hire, namely Balaam, and told him to go to the area where the Israelites had their camp and curse them. Now what happened was, when he tried that, it didn't work the way, you know, the king had hoped it would. Instead of cursing Israel, he gave prophecies that actually talked about a future for Israel, very different of destruction. He said that a star will rise from Jacob and a shoot will sprout up from Israel. So actually, that's a kind of prediction of the Messiah to come. Numbers 24 has that story in there. And so, you know, with his right hand, he points to the area above Mary's head. That would be where the star is. The star will rise from Jacob. So in fact, you know, this is in the catacomb of Priscilla in Rome, and in that same catacomb, there is an arch which has, well, it's in front here, the arch in front, and if you give me the next picture, you'll see it more clearly, you know, what it shows. It shows, again, a woman with a child on your right, and there are three figures walking toward her. Well, who are they? They are the three wise men who come, you know, from the east bringing gifts. There are three only because of the number of gifts that are mentioned in the Gospel of Matthew. You see, we have Christmas stories in the New Testament, in Luke and in Matthew, but not in Mark and John. So in Matthew, these three wise men from the east are mentioned. They are not kings in the context of the catacombs, means in early Christianity. They were simply three wise men who came from the east. and you recognize this because they have certain garments on. They have a Phrygian cap, and they have trousers, which is a sign of Eastern peoples. So actually, you see the same kind of thing on sarcophagi. This is a famous sarcophagus. It is called the dogmatic sarcophagus from the early 4th century. Roman sarcophagi had this form that there is in the middle of one of the long sides a clypeus, that means a round area framing two people. Actually, on this one, the faces of the two people are not completed because, you know, the sculpture was made before it found an owner. So, you know, the sculptor would have to finish the thing after both were buried in there. Now, it's called the sarcophagus, the dogmatic sarcophagus, because it starts on top in the upper register on the left with the creation. The Trinity is portrayed here as three people. God Father is seated in a chair on the left, and the Son and the Spirit are also persons. So this was a sarcophagus that was made with these specific images after the Council of Nicaea in 325, where the determination was made dogmatically that Christ is fully man and fully God. So it's the Trinity here that creates, and they create actually Eve from Adam, who's lying down there. You can see in the next scene, which is the tree with Adam and Eve as a grown-up people, and the serpent. So actually it's the creation of Eve there that's shown, not the creation of the world. And directly underneath you can see there is Mary with a child seated in a throne like God the Father, and she's approached from the right by three people with the Phrygian caps and with the trousers. So the three magi belong to this Christmas picture as well as Mary there. And you can see behind Mary seated, there is again standing a man, and it's most likely not Joseph. It's again Bileam, Balaam, who made this prediction. In fact, the first one of three magi points to a star that is in the border right above the figurines in the lower register. So, you know, the earliest Christmas pictures are Mary and the child plus Balaam, the prophet of the messianic figure who will come. Now let's go to the next one. Yeah. Mary and the child. Well, that becomes in Eastern Christianity the main picture. Greek word for picture is icon. So this is the central icon of Eastern Christianity. Every Eastern Christian knows this. It is Mary, kind of like a majestic figure with the Christ child. Both of them have halos behind them, holding him in her lap. This is the normative icon, the Mary icon in the Eastern Church. It is in Constantinople, in the Hagia Sophia, you know, the major wonderful church in Constantinople. And it has a kind of an inscription above her there. It's in, written in Greek letters, M, and what looks like a P in Greek is an R, M-R. And on the right you have a theta first, that's a TH, and then an Ypsilon, which is our Y in Greek. And these are the abbreviations of two words. MR is Mater, that means mother, and THY is Theou, of God, mother of God. You see, that presupposes that Jesus is regarded as God. And this was settled not at Nicaea yet. This was settled at a council in 431 at Ephesus. Now this council at Ephesus 431 determined that Mary may be called, should be called, Mother of God, not just Mother of Jesus. And it ended a long controversy over 100 years where one party of Eastern Christianity thought that she should not be called Mother of God because she was only Mother of Jesus. But in 431, the determination was made dogmatically that she could be called Mother of God. And that's why, this normative picture repeated hundreds and thousands of times in the Eastern Church. It's called the Mother of God in the East, Constantinople. But this is the same kind of picture in the West. It's in Ravenna, also in Italy, but in northern Italy, on the eastern side of the Italian peninsula. And it was for a while the place of exile for the early Roman emperor. He had to flee, from Rome and was in Ravenna there. Therefore, in the church of San Apollinare Nuovo, you have this same picture of Mary in majesty with a child on her lap. Now, this is the context in the church in Ravenna, where you see the Mary with the child, which we just saw in the previous picture, over there on the right. She is she sits there in regal majesty. That's why this picture in the East is called the Maestà, the majesty. In the West, she also often is called the seat of wisdom, because Christ being wisdom seated on her, she would be the seat of wisdom. So you can see her in Ravenna as a Maestà, or the seat of wisdom. And look at what's on the left here. These are the three wise men again. How did they become kings? Well, that was in the earlier Middle Ages, when certain words from the Psalms, like the kings of Tarshish will bring gifts, were applied to the three wise men, and then by that time they were called three kings. But originally it's just wise men, astrologers, or prophets of sorts. Now here, no.
Carlfried, just to interrupt you quickly, I think we have time for one more picture, so I think we'll have to wrap up after this.
Yeah, we have to go on quickly. So this is, a picture of the seat of wisdom or the Majesta, and it has to do with always with the three kings coming. Christmas originally was celebrated, particularly in Egypt, not on the 25th of December, but on the 6th of January. Now the 6th of January is not only the storming of the capital, it's a Christian festival. We call it Epiphany. So, Epiphany is actually the old Christmas. And you can see to the Christian art of Christmas, mother, child, and the three wise men belong quite naturally. See them down there, two of them on the right, one on the left with their Phrygian caps and their trousers. So that is a normal Christmas picture. It's not the only one. Already in the East, there was another one which was a narrative, a Christmas narrative. And you see this first in churches in the East, in the apse. That means like this one here, that's an apse. This is one form of the Christmas picture, and the other form is the one we see in the next picture. No, not yet. This is still a Majesta, and you can see this is a Western one in the cloisters, Mary and child. Mary as seat of wisdom, the child is lifting his hand in a blessing gesture and a teaching gesture. Well, she is the seat of the wisdom that Jesus Christ brought through his word and teaching, and he blesses the world. Now, these smaller figurines, I said already, in churches, figures in the round, the carved carved in stone or wood, they were much prized by local churches, more so even than the pictures that we saw painted in fresco. So, when you have smaller ones, they can be carried. So they could be carried, in procession around the church, or set on altars. And there are, of course, from the Middle Ages and in Florence, numerous such portable Majestas.
Carlfried, I'm so sorry to have to wrap us up here. You are a tremendous well of information about this, and I feel like I know everyone in this room could listen to you for so much longer.
Yeah, but
I'm starting to hear some rustlings outside.
Yeah.
So I'm going to wrap us up here.
Okay, well, we'll go quickly through.
No, Dad, we don't have, this is what I told you, we don't have time to continue.
Yeah, let's show the next picture, though.
We'll just let everyone look at the next picture. Wonderful. So here's what we'll do. Carlfried, if you are comfortable, I'm sure people would enjoy speaking with you individually.
Good.
If okay, we'll have people come up. You can stay seated comfortably, and people, you're welcome to greet Carlfried. What I'd love to do right now is have a warm round of applause for our speaker.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I'd like to encourage you to come back next week. We will have Maria Lobiondo, our storyteller, returning. She was with us last Advent. This year, she will be doing Where Love Is, God Is by Leo Tolstoy. Thank you so much for being here today, and thank you again to Carlfried.
Thank you.